I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Season 3, Episode 4 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon 1, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And this is Season 3, where we are talking about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. And our guest today is a man who's been around the industry for a long time. He's a photographer. His name is Gary Bartlett. He is from Canada. And I became familiar with Gary because he used to write for Bob Kennedy's Muscle Mag International back in the late 70s, early 80s. And he's stayed with this industry for all these years. So he's got a lot of experience and a lot of stories. And, of course, he was at the 1981 Mr. Olympia. And he's good friends with Winston Roberts, who was a judge from Canada, one of the highest qualified judges of the IFBB at that time. And I believe Winston is still involved with the industry. So Gary's got a lot of great stories. And we're going to talk to him in a minute. I also want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One. At Redcon One, everybody wants to be a champion and everyone wants to be the best. And Redcon One believes in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether it's to kill it in the gym or run a 6-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you the extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then you can feel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. And it is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon 1, the highest state of readiness. And you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get 15% discount off your order because they are sponsoring the show. So please do that. We're also brought to you by Old School Labs. Old School Labs is the sponsor for the new Classic Physique Olympia winner, Breon Ansley. Breon won that contest just a week ago, and Old School Labs is his sponsor along with Sergio Oliva Jr. Now, with so many supplements on the market, it can be hard to know which brand is the right one. But as a 3-time Natural Mr. Universe and Natural Olympia winner, quality of supplements that I take and knowing what I'm taking is very important to me. So that's why we are giving you a 12% off purchase at Old School Labs. Just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at the checkout. Old School Labs is the brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. And it's the brand that I personally used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in the Masters division back in 2012 and many other competitions. Old School Labs is a brand you can trust, and it values the golden era of bodybuilding. So for great results, keep it old school. And again, that is LEGEND12 at oldschoollabs.com. All right, and we get a lot of great feedback from last week's interview with Danny Padilla and Jim Raquel. We got a lot of great emails on that, a lot of great messages on Facebook. People really love that interview because Danny's such a great personality and he was such a great bodybuilder. Speaking of Gary Bartlett, Gary gave me some pictures of the 1981 Mr. Olympia that he took. Some of them are comparison pictures. Some of them are pictures of Tom Platz or Danny Padilla or Roy Callender and Franco and Chris Dickerson posing by themselves. So we have a photo section on the bodybuildinglegendshow.com. So go to that photo section and you can check out that album of the 1981 Mr. Olympia pictures that I've never seen before. And they were great black and white pictures taken by Gary Bartlett. So check that out when you get a chance. And I want to read some emails I got. If you guys want to have any questions or you have any comments about the show, I welcome all of your comments because I want to know how you guys are liking this Bodybuilding Legends podcast and also the website, thebodybuildinglegendsshow.com. You can email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, or if you are friends with me on Facebook, you can do that there or on Instagram. So I got one email here from Robert Walker, and he says, first, I want to say thank you for your podcast. I am old enough to be familiar with most of the people you've interviewed, and the experience has brought back many fond memories, as well as exposing me a number of things I had not known at the time. Please keep this effort going. And then he says, I listened to your series on the 1981 Mr. Olympia coincidentally while on an airplane returning from the 2017 Olympia. I found it ironic that I had also attended the 1981 event, and the podcast brought back many of the same recollections I had of the contest. Since that time, I have seen more than 24 Olympias, and I have yet to see a physique as beautiful and well-proportioned as Danny Padilla's was on that occasion. In addition to everything said about the contest, I have some recollections, a couple of them personal, that made this a special contest for me. Although this was not my first Olympia, I had never had the opportunity to see a professional bodybuilder up close. However, on this occasion, Tom Platz and I happened to arrive at the Columbus Airport at the same time. We wound up walking down the concourse together. My mouth literally dropped open when I first saw him about 3 feet away. He was wearing a gray sweatsuit that stretched the fabric to its limits, and no one will ever convince me that his upper body had not caught up with his legs. There was not any place to put another pound of muscle on him. Right after the show, I somehow found myself in the darkened Veterans Memorial parking lot. There I saw Franco Colombo, his then wife, and I believe one other person about to get into a car. Franco was carrying his trophy, and there was nobody else around. I thought, well, what a fitting ending to what had been a ludicrous outcome. Thirdly, although none of your guests have mentioned it, I found that Samir Banute's posing routine at the show to be the most memorable I've ever witnessed, and I have seen Ed Corney pose. I have yet to see another routine where the music and the posing so complemented each other to form a single integrated whole. By the way, I understand you're going to have Samir on your show again. Please ask him what music he used for that Olympia. I have been curious ever since as to its identity. Yeah, hopefully we will be talking to Samir soon. We just did an interview with Roy Callender. We're going to be talking to him next week about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So I hope to have Samir on. And I was also at that show, and I remember that posing routine that Robert is talking about. It was amazing. And what was even better was the crowd reaction to it. The sound was ready to blow the roof off. It was just absolutely insane. And I agree with him. It was one of the most well-received posing routines I ever saw. It was just the right combination of perfect poses, perfectly choreographed to the music. He did an amazing, amazing job. So I think I have a video of that. So maybe if we interview Samir, I can play that posing routine during our interview, you know, just so you guys could hear the crowd, how absolutely nuts it was. I also got an email from Bill Nylon, and Bill is a friend of mine. He's an old school bodybuilder like myself. He's a really good friend of Chris Dickerson, and Bill lives in the South Florida area, and he is a judge with the MPC. So Bill has been around for a long time, and whenever I get a chance to sit down and talk to Bill, we always talk for like hours about old school bodybuilding. So Bill sent me an email, and he said, there's a lot of clowns that shouldn't even be in the sport. However, when I look back on it, John, that's always been the case. There's just so many more now and there's so much vanity. That's why it's so refreshing, your interview with truly accomplished men like John Balick, who doesn't have an arrogant bone in his body. And when he speaks, you know it's authentic. I first met John in 1996 in Oxnard, California at Ironman headquarters. What a thrill for me. He was candid and pleasant. I saw him again at Joe Weider's 90th birthday dinner. I went as Chris Dickerson's guest. A total of less than 35 people were there without Arnold and Franco. All the Mr. O's were there through Ronnie, a veritable who's who of the sport. Tom Dieters, Ed Connors, Lou Ferrigno, Albert Busack, Bob Goldman, Rafael Montoya. We sat at a table with Drs. Terry and Jan Todd, and I mentioned my venerable trainer, Carol Whitfield, whom they knew very well. Carol had trained Paul Anderson earlier in his career, and he trained 1959 Mr. America Harry Johnson, along with Bill Curry Sr. Man, I was like a kid in the candy store, and I got to meet everybody. So that was a great email from Bill Nylon. Thanks for Bill for listening to the show. And then I got another email here from Jerry. And he says, I listened to your interview with Roger Schwab today regarding the 1981 Mr. Olympia. At one point, you were discussing the individual scoring by judges. When you review Jim Mannion's scores, it apparently contradicts what's published in your 1981 Mr. Olympia Part 2 summary. You and Roger said Mannion had Danny with a total of 59 after the three rounds. On the score sheet published in your article, it has Danny with a 53 from Mr. Mannion. I could never figure out how he had Danny so low after three rounds, and then he put him in first in the pose down. You also point this out in your summary. Any clarification regarding this would be appreciated. As a fan of the sport since the mid-70s, I'd enjoy knowing which account is the accurate one. Thank you, Jerry. Yeah, good question. I did mess up in that article that I wrote a few years ago. I think it was for RX Muscle about the 1981 Olympia. And the scores that I mentioned with Roger, where Jim had Danny with 59 points, total points, after the three rounds, that's the accurate one. And I got those score sheets from Randy Roach's book, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, and that was his volume three. And at the end of volume three, Randy has the scores from both the 1980 and the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So that was my screw up. I don't know where I got those scores, but I got them from a magazine. But obviously, those were the wrong scores. They were inaccurate. So the ones that me and Roger talked about on our podcast, that's the most accurate one. Jim Mannion, obviously a great judge. He's been around forever. So, yeah, he had Danny pretty much in first place along with Franco, and then he put Danny in first in the pose down. So that's the correct information. And I also want to mention we are brought to you by our another sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. And they offer a wide range of services to ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but you're also comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They offer very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. So give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. As a tribute to the show, you can use the promotion code LEGEND and get a free consultation and then get 20% off any package you order. So you can call them directly at their office number, which is 813-906-6737, or go to their website, which is FL Alternative MED, Florida Alternative Medicine, FLAlternativeMED.com, and check them out and give them a call. They are in the Tampa area, but they will work with anybody in the United States. All right, so that's it. I want to thank again our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. They have gotten behind this podcast, so I hope you guys will really go to their website and support them, because without them, we could not do the show. So please give them a little love. Go there and purchase some of their products or give them some support. All right, here is our interview with the photographer, Gary Bartlett, where we're going to talk about his career and about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. Here you go. Okay, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show. And my special guest this week is Gary Bartlett from Canada, calling in from Canada. And Gary was a big photographer for Robert Kennedy's Muscle Mag International. Growing up, I would see his pictures and his reports from Canada all the time. He is here to join us. We're going to talk about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much, John, for having me on your show. It's a great show, and it's really nice to see someone taking a keen interest in the history of our sport.
Thank you. Yeah, I grew up during those times, and I think that's a magical era, so I want to keep bringing it back as much as I can. Let's talk about your career, because I know you've had a long, long career, but before we get into how you got into bodybuilding and covering the sport as a photographer, you just got back from Vegas, and you were at the 2017 Mr. Olympia. So what did you think of the show? Let me hear your thoughts of the contest.
It was very well organized, of course, by AMI and Robert Chang. They do a fantastic job in doing what they have to work with. And I don't mean to say run anybody down, but the pros now, there's not a lot of excitement created anymore, because there's not a lot of, you know, when they had Ronnie and Jay, and they had, of course, Jay and Phil for a while, and then, of course, they had Kai and Phil. But now we really don't have that kind of rivalry that exists on the stage. And I've seen it for the last couple of years, that there's not a lot of rivalry where you have a huge section in the audience cheering for one and a huge section in the audience supporting another. Now, a lot of your success of your shows, in my experience, comes from the feedback from the audience. Mm-hmm. And of course, the competitors feed off the crowd. And
yeah.
If the crowd is, you know, lackadaisical, or, you know, not overly hyped on a particular competitor, then it kind of falls a little short, and it you don't get that spark that we saw when we had some of those really intense rivalries. Now, this year, there was a bit of excitement with Big Ramy, because Big Ramy was second against Phil, and Ramy looked very good, probably the best he's ever looked. In fact, he looked a lot better on Saturday night than he did at the prejudging.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday night, he pushed Phil pretty good, but he still doesn't have the finish or the quality in his separation of his muscles that Phil still has. I mean, Phil's got the roundness and the fullness, and Rami still, you know, doesn't have that granite hard look yet, but he's getting closer. The gap this year, the gap this year got a bit closer, and Rami did create quite a interest from the crowd. I mean, I think the biggest response of anybody on stage came when Big Rami came out.
Yeah.
And I think it's no discredit to Phil, because Phil was a sure cut winner again, and he looked great. But the crowd likes to see a underdog take the champ out. And I saw that with Jay when he beat Ronnie, and I saw it with Phil when he beat Jay. So now it's almost like the audience is looking for a new champion to beat Phil. So
yeah, that's normal with the Mr. Olympia, right? That always happens after they won a few times.
Definitely. And I think Kai was one of their favorites when Kai was pushing Phil.
Yeah.
A lot of them were pro Kai, but Kai sort of went on his own way here now, and seems to be on a different agenda than winning the Olympia. But it was a great show with all the new divisions, and I mean, there's nothing in that Mr. Olympia that doesn't cater to some kind of aspect of the fitness industry. But for me, of course, it's hardcore Mr. Olympia bodybuilding, which is my roots come back from, you know, many years ago. So overall, you know, it was a great show and everything, and well done, and only that Vegas can make it like that. I think if the show was anywhere else but Vegas, it would be not as big a success, unless maybe it was in Europe, because I think it's pretty huge over there. But I think if you put it anywhere else in North America, I don't think you'd have the impact that what Robin Chang and his people do by bringing it to Vegas.
What do you think of that new classic physique division? Because I'm getting a lot of feedback on that. A lot of people love that new division.
I think it's great. I'm not overly excited on what they wear as trunks.
Yeah.
Because I think it does take away from the quads and make some fellows look longer, shorter in the waist and shorter in the legs. You know what I mean? The symmetry doesn't seem to work out when you have great quad development and when you have those particular shorts, but I guess that's the distinction, one of the distinctions between that and the open division or the 212-pound division, so unless they modify it down the road. But other than that, I think it's a great addition. It gives another place for Zane-type classic physique guys to go who would probably not be able to compete anymore, and also would appeal more to the general public who want to get in shape and who like to work out, but have no desire to ever put on the kind of mass and bulk and freaky muscle like Big Rami or Phil or the other guys have. So
yeah,
there's certainly a good niche in there for it. I mean, it definitely adds to the show and can certainly display some beautiful shaped, symmetrical physiques and bring back some of the aesthetics again.
Yeah, I thought some of the guys looked fantastic, especially like the first
My particular favorite was Bumstead, who I thought should have won.
Yeah.
I thought he stood out. In fact, I sat beside Dave Palumbo, and Dave and I both said he had to show hands down. We didn't think it was a contest, but I think the kid looks fantastic. I think he's a look that brings to the stage. I think that's what, you know, everybody should attire to look like, his type of symmetry and aesthetics. And he has looks, movie star looks. He's got everything going for him.
Yeah.
And he towers over everybody else. I mean, if you go on overall symmetry and shape and conditioning and size, he dominates. But the fellow that beat him, can't take anything away from him. He had a very well-conditioned, compact physique himself and a great set of arms. And
yeah,
Bumstead's arms are just a little bit, probably the weak part of his body, but that shouldn't overrule, you know, the whole overall look.
Yeah.
But you know what? You know, I just wrote about it. I didn't judge. It's my opinion. My opinion. So I've gotten a lot of trouble with my opinions over the years, John, what I used to write about some of the shows.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one such story when we get on to the 81 Olympia, and you'll get a kick out of that.
I was surprised at how big Bumstead looked, you know, for, because I remember when this division first started and they had weight restrictions for how tall you were. I thought that was going to limit the amount of muscle mass, you know, but
that's the conversation that Dave and I had, because he looked so much bigger than everybody else. And Dave and I were scratching their heads trying to figure out how he could make the division, you know, with the height weight requirement. But obviously his muscle is very well distributed, and he obviously made the class or he wouldn't be in there, but he must have a knack for making weight and then filling out after. That's like a UFC fighter or something like that. Because he had to be 10 or 15 pounds heavier than when he weighed in. At least he looked it anyway.
Yeah, I want to mention also that Breon Ansley looked really good too. He almost reminded me of like a Robbie Robinson from the 70s, you know, with that finished physique biceps and everything, you know.
Yeah, Robbie had those high peak biceps and those high lats and that tiny waist and then big quads.
Yeah. So
Robbie had the classic physique back in the day.
For sure.
One of the guys that probably uncrowned Mr. Olympia. There's a lot of guys that should have won the Olympia, and Rob Reif was probably one of them. Another one probably was Flex Wheeler.
What did you think of Flex? Because he made his comeback at 52 years old.
He looked amazing for what he's been through. I mean, he talked on stage about the health issues he's dealt with, and then to come out considering those health issues and his age and looking the way he did was really quite incredible. I mean, most people would never ever even be able to crawl to a gym having gone through what Flex has gone through. Not much mentioned get in shape for to get on the Mr. Olympia stage. It's obviously a testament to what he's got inside of him, champion's heart, to have that motivation and, you know, to sacrifice and push himself to be able to get in that kind of condition, considering the kidney problems and all the health problems that he's facing. I mean, it's really quite amazing, and that's what you have to admire about him. You know, there's lots of trophies and that, but in the end, it's what he's accomplished that in his career that is, and what he's overcame to accomplish that. It's what's quite intriguing, you know, and a true champion, you know. A shame he never got that Olympia title years ago, because that's when it sort of shifted over to the big guys.
Let's go back to the beginning for you, Gary. Like, how did you get involved with the sport of bodybuilding and then becoming a photographer for MuscleMag?
It's a funny thing, John, because, you know, I scratch my head every day trying to think how that happened, considering where I came from. I lived out in a rural area, 40 miles from the city where I live now, and this city's about 50,000, and I had no contact with bodybuilding back in the 60s. This is when I would have, you know, back in the 60s is when I started training myself at the age of 15. I think how it started out, I was always into athletics in school, and I was probably about 135, you know, 40 pounds at 5'8". So I wasn't a big guy, but I was fairly athletic, so I used to do track and field, so I went into the local magazine store. Of course, in those days, the magazine stores were filled with various magazines long before the internet came, and there was a lot of magazines devoted to bodybuilding. And I seen one up in the rack, it was called All American Athlete, which was a Weider magazine at the time, but it was devoted to athletics. And in the articles in that magazine was weight training for track and field. And there was ads in there for protein powder and stuff featuring Harold Poole. And Harold Poole was doing the most muscular pose, and that just shocked me. I couldn't believe any human being could look like that. We called him Plastic Man because he looked like he was made from plastic.
Right.
So I started lifting weight. I coaxed my mother into getting me a set of weights for Christmas. And the funniest part was when I got those weights for Christmas and opened them, I was disappointed because they didn't say Weider on them. That's how much Weider had brainwashed everybody back then. I thought I wouldn't be able to grow, you know, build muscle as good if the weights weren't Weider. Talk about brainwashing. So they were made by Weider, but there was another name on them called J.C. Higgins, which was a Canadian sporting goods company. So, of course, Weider founded them for them. But they were really Weider weights in disguise. So anyway, I started working out with them, and then later on I did get a set of Weider weights, but I worked out in my bedroom, believe it or not. Started getting all the magazines and following the bodybuilding world in those days. Of course, my hero was Larry Scott. And
right.
Following him in those days, and Larry was featured quite a bit in Muscle Power. And then I got a bunch of older magazines from a relative who kept them, 1954 Weider magazine. So I read those. And so I'd become a bit of a, and I, of course, I would get every Weider magazine, and every, not Weider, every bodybuilding magazine that was out there at the time. Mm-hmm. My poor mother, she would come to Fredericton to shop, and I'd give her a list of these magazines to buy. So she'd be laying all the five or six of these publications onto the counter, and of course she'd get the strange look from the clerk who owned the magazine store. Mm-hmm. So she'd bring them home to me. I could hardly wait for the car to drive in the yard so I could grab the magazines, go up and lock myself in the bedroom and read them cover to cover, and then of course get all fired up, go for a workout. I think we all have similar stories when we had that kind of passion for bodybuilding. That was the thing that brought us all together once you got the bug. So I worked
amazing
for a while.
The power of the magazines had back then, you know, because I was the same way. We'd wait every month for the new one to come out and read it from cover to cover.
Yeah, now it's instant on the internet. Everybody's a editor now.
Yeah, right.
And the thing was is that like we never knew who won the Olympia for about 3 months after.
Right.
We didn't have any way of knowing until we got the magazine. But now it's instantaneous. But those were the days. I mean, there was a lot of magazines. I remember once walking into the same magazine store. And it's funny because, John, that goes back to the 70s and the late 60s when I was buying them.
Okay.
And to this day, the gentleman who owned the magazine store, him and his brother owned it, and they're actually retired now, and I run into them on the golf course. They're in their 80s now playing golf, and every time I look at them, I think of how many magazines I bought from them over the years,
right.
Bodybuilding magazines. But getting back to what we were saying, I moved down here to Fredericton, which, as I said, 40 miles from where I live, or where mm-hmm. I grew up, you know, on a farm, and started training at the YMCA, where I met up with my friends, who were the Roy Callender story I told you. And then I began training at the Y, and we managed to convince the superintendent there to put our own weights and build some benches and that put in. So I trained there. In 1975, I was walking into the Y for a workout, and I seen a handmade poster on the wall on the bulletin board, the 1975 New Brunswick Bodybuilding Championships. I was like in shock because I didn't know that they even had bodybuilding contests around where I lived. There was no information about Canadian bodybuilding in the magazines at all, nothing. It was all U.S. and the IFBB and Santa Monica, and of course if you bought the Bob Hoffman magazines, it was the AAU. So anyway, my wife said to me, you know what? She said, you should enter that. She said, you should win that show. I said, well, I don't know anything about posing or any of that stuff. And she said, well, mm-hmm. you should win. You might meet other people like yourself. In other words, she's trying to tell me I might meet other freaks. That's what we were back then.
Right.
So in 75, I did go and compete and won my division, and with a lackluster, you know, a pretty awkward posing routine and all that. But in those days, that's all we had. We just got it from the magazines. There's no coaches, trainers, none of the stuff you get today. Mm-hmm. And met some friends, and actually met Winston Roberts, had come down from Montreal, who was Ben Weider's right-hand man. And Winston was the general secretary of the IFBB, and Winston came down and actually ran the show, emceed it, and put it together for us. And I got to be good friends with Winston. So Winston started encouraging me to come to Montreal and, you know, and continue on with bodybuilding, you know, to where. So what happened then was in 1976, he had the World Championships in Montreal, and he had the Canadian Championships in Montreal as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually went up to it, and Winston kind of looked after me, and I went up to the show and competed in the Canadians.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
Yeah, and that's the first time in my life, John, that ever I knew I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
If there had been a crack in the stage floor, I would have slipped down into it to go into hiding. I was so outclassed and outmuscled that I was like, what am I doing here? Never felt so out of place. So anyway, I learned one thing. My place was not on the stage.
Right.
So, and that at that show, they had Arnold was there, Franco Colombo was there, Danny Padilla competed against Muhammad McAway, Robbie Robinson was against Mike Menster. I met Mike Menster. Lou Ferrigno was there. Franco Colombo was there in guest pose. I mean, everybody who was anybody in the bodybuilding world at that time was at that show in Montreal.
Wow.
So I got to go to an Arnold seminar, and that was a seminar that Arnold spent 2 or 3 hours with people and taped the whole thing and put it in, had that on record. And
wow, really?
Yeah, took a couple of photos and stuff, and of course I wasn't a photographer then. And when I got back home, I competed some local shows a little bit more, and then I started going to the Canadian Nationals, taking photos at it, and started learning. What came to me was that nobody was taking photographs of the bodybuilders. Like, I would compete here, and there was no photographers, and I never could get any good photos of myself. Like,
right.
I give my camera to my wife, and she'd take what she could at the time, but I never really get any photos like I saw in the magazines. And so what I would do, I would take my camera, and then if there was guys on the stage, I put my sweatsuit on, run down in front of the stage and shoot pictures of them, then go back up and compete and run down again when my class wasn't up.
Wow.
So then I would go home.
You basically got into photography because no one else was doing it and there was a need to be filled, huh?
Pretty well. And I started developing stuff on my own, like doing darkroom work and my own color development. And so I learned a lot of how to shoot based on the, you know, what I was looking for in a final product. So I learned, self-taught, learned over the years and got better at it. But I learned with the locals and stuff. So then, like I said, I started going to the Nationals. And Winston encouraged me to get me in because we were good friends. And of course, I met Roy Kalner and people like that. But I was at a Canadian National, and I never could figure out why I never saw very many pictures of Canadian bodybuilders in Muscle Mag when Muscle Mag was published in Canada. And I was at one of the Canadian championships, and I looked in the press pit, and Robert Kennedy was there. And I hooped out. First thing I said to him, which is funny, I said, Mr. Kennedy, and he looked around, and I said, what kind of film do you use? He kind of looked at me and answered, and that was about it. So when I look in the magazines, and he used to have these magazines out. I don't know if you've ever seen them, John. They were he used to put these annuals out every year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've still got those.
Yep, I have some here. Well, he would cover the Canadians in them sometimes.
Yeah.
But there wasn't very good quality photos, and I would see them, and I'd think, well, my photos look that, you know, as good as those. So I got a hold of Robert, and I asked him, I said, you know, if I send you some photos I took of the Canadians, would you look at them? So he said, yeah, send them up.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent them to him, and then I typed up an article about Canadian championships, pretty basic in that. He actually published it in one of those annuals. So then I started sending him a little bit more, and then I started sending some pictures to Iron Man, the old Iron Man, the real good Iron Man, Perry Radar Iron Man.
Uh-huh.
Perry started publishing some of them, and then I started covering shows for Perry, and it grew from there. I had a passion for bodybuilding, and I got to be pretty good at photography. So for the magazines, they didn't have a very big budget.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than having someone go separately to write it and then have to go separately for photos, they had sort of send them the whole thing together, and the expenses weren't very high for them. So I kind of served as a reporter for Iron Man and Muscle Mag, and, you know, there's several other ones too that I used to write for back in those days. I think at one time I was writing for five or six different magazines because I was doing some for some people in Europe as well.
Yeah.
But my first published article, I think, which had to deal with the mainstream other than the Canadian scene, was the 79 Mr. Olympia. That was my first Olympia I'd ever went to. Winston got me in the press pit, and that's the one where Frank Zane was against Mike Mentzer. See, at that time they had two divisions, a heavyweight and under 200, like over 200, under 200. Mm-hmm. Frank won the under 200, and Mike won the over 200. That was initiated with Arnold and Franco. So anyway, Zane ended up beating Mentzer, and I thought Mentzer should have won. So I wrote, I didn't think Mentzer should have won, but a lot of people thought he should have. So I wrote an article called In Defense of Zane.
Okay.
And I sent it to Weider Publications, because I got to know Bill Reynolds, who was the editor this was before Flex. It was Muscle Power, I think. And so I knew Bill, and I told Bill I had written this article, and I told him that I thought Zane, I said, in defense of Zane. So I wrote and critiqued Zane and Mentzer in the article and wrote why I thought Zane should have won. And then I sent a bunch of slides that I had taken from the show, comparing them together, just those two. And then in the article, I explained, you know, Zane should have won in this pose. And had. So Joe thought it was great. And this is a true story, because Bill told me this after. So Joe had it all laid out with the slides and everything on the desk and that, and they were going over it to publish it, and Mike Mentzer walks in. Mike lost it. You're not running that article. There's no way you're going to run that article.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, you can't. You see, Mike was working with Weider then. I think he had doing articles and that for them. See, in those days, what they did was for advertising your courses and that, you wrote articles and stuff for them.
Yes.
There wasn't a lot of money exchange hands. It was sort of the barter system. So, of course, Mike came in, and this would make him look bad, and, of course, make his product look bad, because he was in that heavy-duty training, and there's no way he was going to run the article. And he took the slides and left, and Joe ran it anyway, but without the slides.
Wow.
I don't know where the slides went. I don't know, to this day, I didn't have copies because they were the original.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but Joe did run the article with a few pictures, but only a couple, like nothing that would really show what I was writing about. So that was my first published article, and I have it here still, but I'd like to have those slides back.
Yeah, but I think I remember that article. I think I remember an article called In Defense of Zane.
Well, that would have been it, yeah. And that sort of got me going, and then I said to Bob at the time, I said, Bob, you know what? There's no – Bob did start covering the Canadian championships. I'd cover it for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, Bob, you know, there's no coverage of Canadians anywhere. You know, it's like we got some good bodybuilders here, and it's like we don't exist. I said, between, you know, all the U.S. stuff and then Europe and that, England and stuff, I said, nobody knows that there's even Canadian bodybuilding going on.
Yeah.
I said, maybe, you know, I could write a column in your magazine every month called Canadian Corner, and I could cover what's happening on the scene here, and it would help, you know, stir up some interest and even get more Canadians buying the magazine. So he gave me the go-ahead to do that article, and I think I did it for 25 years without missing
it.
Maybe even more than 25. I don't have the exact number. I started doing it, I think, in the early 80s, and then right up close to the end. And then I also even had a training corner called Gary's Corner at one time.
Okay. What year did you start working for Bob, for his magazine?
I think it was probably early 80s, I think.
Okay.
Late, yeah. I think the first Canadians that I covered was 1980, maybe, that he put in his annual.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, and after that, I think I started doing Canadian Corner, start covering the Canadians, but it was probably 81 around there.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I remember first seeing Bob's magazine when I, this time I didn't send my mother, I went myself, and went in and saw the magazines, and then the usual, you know, muscle training and strength and health and muscle fitness and...
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had one there, another bodybuilding one that Weider was doing, All-American, I think it was. And then there was the Bob Hoffman ones. And then there was one up there, a new one, called Muscle Mag International.
Yeah.
And remember the little caption I had on the outside, you can buy this magazine because it's going to be a collector's item.
Right, right.
Yeah, I remember written down in the corner, and I bought that, and have every issue since. I have every issue of Muscle Mag.
Wow.
But
how was it? What was it like to work for Bob Kennedy?
Bob was very, very passionate. He loved bodybuilding. I mean, we shared an extreme passion for bodybuilding. We could talk about it for hours. Then he had Johnny Fitness, who was his editor, right up to the end. Gino Edwards, his real name is, and him and Bob were childhood friends. They grew up together and went to art school together and everything, and they both had great passion. They would tell me stories about going to the NABBA universe and meeting Reg Park, and they were just youngsters and stuff. So, I mean, we all had that same light that Sean that got us going at one time by meeting some, celebrities of the day. So Bob was very good at encouraging you to do better.
Yeah.
Like I would write and he would encourage me, keep at it, boy. He'd say, you're getting better. And he had a great ability to get people to be loyal and work for him and try to do their best. And he'd play one against the other to try to get better out of everybody. And he'd always instruct me on my photography and say, well, do this next time, or you're getting better, or you can do better than that. And then he would always encourage you, and then he would support you by, purchasing photos and articles and stuff. So Bob used me very, very well, and is responsible for the career and the success that I did have in the industry. It was Bob that was responsible. Bob and Winston Roberts, because Winston was the first one to let me in the door, and then hadn't been for Winston and our friendship, I probably wouldn't have gotten in the door to be able to meet Bob and send photos and stuff to him. And I worked for Perry Radar for a long time as well, because I loved Iron Man. I spoke to Perry over the phone a lot, but I never ever met him face-to-face. Yeah, I never met him personally. We talked, for hours on the phone. He was the same way, had a huge passion for weight, for bodybuilding and stuff.
Yeah.
Bob, and I think if you talk to most people, John, they'll probably tell you the same thing about Bob, that he had a lot to do with their careers, encouraged them and was influential in their success and stuff, because he did help a lot of people. And he was very, very generous with his, he'd never rip you off or never try to get photos from you for nothing and steal anything. He would always pay. In fact, in the first years, for many, many years, you'd send Bob a whole bunch of material, and a week or so later, you'd get it back in the mail with a check for what he took. I mean, he paid you up front.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's seldom you see that in this day and age.
Right. Right.
Bob would send, checks right up front with stuff that he didn't use. He'd get it done and out in a matter of weeks. Until you get, until the company sort of get more corporate, and when it got more corporate, then it got more strict in what it was doing. It wasn't quite like that. Bob was more of a hands-on in the early years, and he did struggle with the publication too. For several times, he almost had to shut down, but he just kept it going and found ways to keep it going. And of course, in the 90s, the supplement. Heavy supplement industry started, and then a lot of money being thrown around in those days with the new supplement companies on the horizon. A lot of people got rich in those supplement companies.
Yeah. Yeah, I always loved Bob's magazine, because when I started reading it, you had Weider's magazine, and Weider, of course, wouldn't talk about any of the other organizations out there like NABBA or Dan Laurie's, and Bob's magazine would cover all of them. He would cover all the shows in England, the universe, and then, like you said, he would cover the Canadian stuff, which you never read about in Leaders Magazine. So,
no,
I learned about a lot of other athletes and bodybuilders that you would never read about in the Leader magazines.
Well, the thing that I always said about Bob's magazine was that it had personality.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's personality came out in the magazine. Like, Bob was a fun, loving, passionate guy who loved bodybuilding and the related industry. He was front and center. I mean, you could always find him at his booth at the Arnold Classic.
And yeah.
He was always out there for people to approach him, and he was approachable, and he was good with people. So, I mean, that came out in his magazine, and as you say, John, it was covered everything. In fact, we got in a lot of trouble back in the 90s when we were covering the Vince McMahon Federation. Remember that? When he had they took a lot of the pros from Weider and started their own organization, and were paying some of the bodybuilders big money, like Gary Stridham and Tom mm-hmm. Platz was their manager, and paying Tom a lot of money to manage it. So Bob had been invited to judge one of the big shows, and of course this was when wars were on, because Ben Weider was president at the time, and you were forbidden to take part in any other organization. So
mm-hmm.
Ben, you know, threatened Bob, you know, and you don't be judging this Vince McMahon organization's contest. So we actually talked Bob out of not judging it. We did cover
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
We went. In fact, it's funny because we went to that show was at the Taj Mahal that Trump had just built. I don't even think mm-hmm. it was finished. I think it was 91 or 92. I think it had just been built or still working on it. And I remember going in and shocked at this building. I'd never seen anything like it. This was in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
And the evening show when it started, because Vince McMahon, he did it like his wrestling. He had all the bells and whistles and fog and smoke and light.
Mm-hmm.
You never seen these at any of the IFBB shows, because they were mm-hmm. more regimented. But it was like a show, and we look over, and there's Donald Trump coming with Marla Maples at mm-hmm. that time.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump sat right in the front row, and he was there for the show, and that was Atlantic City. That was one of the ones I really remember. And Gary Stridham won it, but of course they folded after that, a year or two after that.
Yeah,
They had their own magazine out and everything. They spent a lot of money. This man spent a lot of money promoting it for a couple
mm-hmm.
of years.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob covered to that. I mean, there wasn't anything in the bodybuilding scene that wasn't covered in those days.
Yeah.
He got in trouble for it because, you know, they were pretty strict on, you know, allowing who they were going to allow press passes to if you're loyal to the IFBB.
Right.
But, you know, that's the way it is. We got a mess going on now with the IFBB and the NPC that
mm-hmm.
all broke this last weekend at the Mr. Olympia. I'm sure that you and your associates have probably talked about that and the ramifications of the industry and how it's all going to play down.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that, what happened there. So that was pretty wild, huh?
Well, yeah, and it's funny because there's an Arnold Classic over in Spain this weekend.
Right, right.
I don't know how that's all playing down with everything, because they're all pros, I think, at this Arnold, and
uh-huh.
this is still an IFBB show, unless it's, I don't know who controls it now. I think Raphael's the one that promotes it, so. It's quite a situation. There's going to be a lot of speculation before it gets all settled and
mm-hmm.
everything filters down. So I guess we'll see how it all comes out in the end.
Well, Gary, let's talk about the 81 Olympia. That's what we're talking about in the season of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. You were at that show, correct?
Yes.
So tell us your feelings on how, let's start with the prejudging. When you went to the prejudging, of course, there was a lot of hype going into this because this was a year after Arnold's controversial 1980 Mr. Olympia win in Sydney, Australia. So going into the show, we had a lot of the guys who weren't expected to be in great shape, like Danny Padilla and Roy Callender and Tom Platz, and they were at their lifetime best. And then some of the guys that we were expecting to see there, like Mike Mentzer and Frank Zane and Boyer Coe, they were all absent because they were boycotting the show. So what were your initial feelings when the lineup came out and you saw how everybody was looking?
At first, we were real disappointed, John, just to go back a bit. We were really disappointed because we were expecting, with what everything that happened the year before in Australia, we were expecting, you know, a real fierce battle with the guys that were going to prove themselves
mm-hmm.
because they didn't win in Australia. So we were expecting, you know, Mike Mentzer would come back, and as you said, Frank Zane and Boyer Coe and all the main guys and Chris
right.
Dickerson and we expected a, and then we heard none of them were competing, and we were like, huge letdown. We were like, you know, who, you know, we're only going to get second string guys. I mean, guys that couldn't place in the top 10 before, that's all we're going to have. And it's very disappointing to hear that. And, you know, we never really were overly excited about Franco because he hadn't competed in a while, and he wasn't, you know, didn't have the charisma that some of them had at that time. Because there was a lot of hype around Menser and Corsain. And so when the lineup come out, and we looked up and seen the lineup, it was like jaws were hitting the floor because Danny Padilla looked unbelievable. Roy Callender was in the best shape of his life, and then Tom Platz just took it to another level. And I wrote an article once called The Olympia Zone, where I wrote all about how shocked we were and in detail about how, you know, about the conditionings of Danny and Roy and Platz, where they took it to the Olympia level, which a level that they'd never been before. We were like,
I think I remember that one too.
I was in Muscle Training Illustrated.
That was an interesting article. You were talking about how a guy has to get to a certain level in order to be able to win the Olympia, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And that's what it was about, and taking it to that level, which those guys did.
Right.
They all could have been Mr. Olympia. I mean, they were, all of them except Franco.
My
opinion. I thought they you know, most of us were shocked when we saw it, and of course, just as shocked when the announcement of the results. And for me, I think if you look at any, you can take each one on their own merit and make an argument for each one that could have won. Personally, I thought Franco had very little leg separation or muscularity.
Right,
and I thought he had. His pecs had, of course, noticeable signs of pitched it. And he had a gravelly look to his skin. He just didn't look finished or as, you know, just didn't have it. You know the look when they have it.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked good. Don't get me wrong there. I mean, he was in good. He had lots of muscle in the ring, but not to the caliber of those other three guys.
Right.
And now Danny was absolutely on the brink of probably dropping dead. He was so his skin was so thin,
right?
And his cheeks were sucked right in, and every muscle and striation and vein was showing on him. I mean, Danny looked unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody ever could achieve the kind of conditioning he was in that day. I don't know what the poor bugger did, but it must have been some grueling for him.
Right.
And Roy Callender looked like he was chiseled from coal. He was just so hard. And then Platz was the fullest and the thickest muscle that I'd ever seen him. I mean, he was, the legs were just unbelievable. I mean, it's just I can still see them now, and there's very few times in my career that I was shocked in the bodybuilding world, and it takes a lot more now to shock me, of course, than way back then when I was much younger and more passionate, more impressionable.
Yeah.
But I still remember those guys and the impact they had. And then when placing started and the crowd started booing and that, then a lot of us who were passionate back then were pretty angry about the outcome. I remember here's a good story. I was standing in the lobby of the hotel the morning after, and we were debating it and, you know, talking about it and running down the judges and, you know, have everybody choose over a show after. And Winston Roberts comes over, and Winston was one of the judges, of course. And Winston was a good friend of mine, and we were getting into a passionate argument about it, and I was taking up the cause for Tom Platz. And Winston says, Gary. Gary, said Winston, talks with a West Indian accent. He said, how could you make Mr. Olympia with a man whose thighs are so overdeveloped from the rest of his physique? I said, Winston, you gave it to a guy with no legs at all. And just to look in everybody's face, you know, it's kind of true, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. What did he say to that?
He kind of looked at me and he rolled his eyes, and I think he knew that there's no point in arguing with me about that, because there was no way I was going to be reasoned with.
And who did Winston have in third place?
I think he had Franco.
Really?
I can't say for sure, but I think he was. I think the trend was to go with Franco. You know, mm-hmm. I can't say it was rigged. I can't say it was fixed, because I don't have any evidence to say that, or because I wasn't a part of the inner circle of who was controlling what and the judging and stuff. But I think that somebody had to vote for Franco, or he wouldn't have won.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Me and Roger Schwab, who was the head judge at that show, we did an interview a couple weeks ago, and we analyzed the judges' score sheets, and we found that the real fault seemed to be the point system instead of the placing system, and too many of the judges gave Franco high scores, and overall, then he ended up winning, you know. So
he won on points rather than on placings.
Exactly, right.
But you think the guys that were doing the judging, I mean, if they're going to give a guy a score, the score would have to be the same as being placed them number one.
Mm-hmm.
Did he win by many points?
It wasn't unanimous, but I think he did win by a pretty good margin. And the other thing we found out was a lot of those judges, we didn't think were qualified to judge the Olympia. That's what Roger was saying. You know, they were from other countries, and I guess Ben Leader won an international panel. But they really weren't ready to judge a contest of the caliber of the Olympia. They just weren't ready to see those kind of physiques, you know.
Yeah, and they would be influenced by him as well, by his reputation and his name.
They
weren't looking at what was on stage in front of their eyes. And
how would you have placed it, Gary?
That was something, you know, John, that has played around in my mind for since then, and that's a long time ago. I mean, I really fought with how I would have placed it, because all three of those guys, an argument could have made for them. If he went on pure conditioning and symmetry, it would be Danny Padilla.
Yeah.
But Danny wasn't a showman on stage. He wasn't.
Yeah.
He was very.
Agree.
Yeah. Danny always had a shyness about him and a lackluster attitude, where he didn't seem to have that killer instinct where he really showed that he wanted something.
Mm-hmm.
Now he did show it in his conditioning and what he had sacrificed to get in that shape.
Yeah.
But it didn't come out on stage where he was fierce or highly competitive, where he, you know, projected to the audience that I really, really want this.
Yeah.
In contrast, Tom Platz just gulps up an audience, and the more attention he gets from the audience, the more he can get out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom had a charisma of a movie star. You know, he could get an audience really going and in his favor.
Yeah.
And given that, and given the conditioning and the development that he displayed at that show, I probably would have went with Tom. I wouldn't have been shocked if Tom had won it. Now he did have huge quads that nobody else had, and it certainly did overshadow his upper body, but I think that's the closest he'd ever gotten to matching them in his career for that show.
Yeah, I thought his upper body was so much improved, you know.
Yeah, and that was just before he tore. That was just before he tore his bicep.
Yeah, because
I was in '82 in England.
Yeah,
he tore his bicep getting ready for that Olympia. And his career.
What did you think of Roy Callender?
Roy probably had a package that could have been awarded the title as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy really didn't have a lot of any weaknesses. But Roy is a little bit, doesn't come quite across as Platz either as when he's on stage. Like he still has a little bit of a shyness to him, as well.
Although I thought that was the most aggressive Roy I ever saw, you know, because I saw him compete a few years before that in Olympia.
Yeah, Roy was a little bit less aggressive before, but yeah, this was probably the hardest that Roy really wanted it.
He was challenging Franco right from the beginning. Remember, right when they walked out.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have been surprised or disappointed if Roy had won either. I mean, like I said, if you sit down with a good panel of bodybuilding keeners who know their history and stuff, who were there for that show, mm-hmm. I think we could all make an argument for one, not one or the other, and never really agree on who should have won.
Right.
It would probably come down to your personal favorite of what you liked. But it's one of those things that you had to be there to see it, I guess. And I probably would have went with very, 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 it would have been a photo finish between those three. You know?
Yeah.
Just to place the top three would have been tough to be fair to them, because they were all that good. So how did that go? First was Franco. Who was second?
Dickerson was second. Platts was third. Roy was fourth. And Danny was fifth.
I certainly wouldn't have had Dickerson in there at
all.
Yeah,
right.
Dickerson was good the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And he was good in 82. But I wouldn't have had him in that running, in that group. I probably would have had him ahead of Franco, maybe Franco fifth and Dickerson fourth, maybe.
That's the way I would have had him. Gary, talk about the crowd back then, because, you know, I know things have changed now. That was 35 years ago, but... Talk about how loud that audience was. And I thought Roger Schwab made a good point when I talked to him, and he said that the bodybuilding audiences back then were very sophisticated, and they knew how to look at a physique, you know, and this is before physiques got super big, you know, and they could recognize someone's symmetry and, you know, the proportions of the body.
Yeah, Roger's right. They were cultured. They were an educated crowd. They were hard, you know, they were... Much like to what you see now in the UFC fans, you know,
mm-hmm.
if you follow the UFC, that type of crowd was what we had back then.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to a UFC weigh-in, and you get more of a crowd than you get at some of our shows now, some of our professional shows. And there was no crowd like the Columbus crowd. There's two or three times, John, that I had shivers go down my neck.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was, I think, the 79 Olympia. Frank was announced last. He walked out on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And he just stood there. I still remember like it was like yesterday. He stood there. Mm-hmm. He looked around. Never moved. Just looked around for a minute or so. And people, you could feel the anticipation of the crowd getting you know, more intense. It was almost like electricity was going through them. Of course, that was at the Veterans, which no longer exists now.
Right.
And I think it held maybe, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000, maybe that many. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
4,000,
yeah.
Maybe. Anyway, every one of those people in that audience of 4,000 would be 10 at some of the other shows you'd go to. And
mm-hmm.
maybe like 10 people scream and yell instead of one.
Right.
And so Zane suddenly clinched his fist, and he was so ripped that you could see the striations just start in his forearms and work right up through his body as if like he was struck by a bolt of electricity. It's almost like he was playing Frankenstein, and they give him a bolt of electricity from the lightning, and Frankenstein came alive.
Right.
Well, that's the way his physique came. It was like his muscles on his physique all came alive,
mm-hmm.
and they just striated all across and jumped and popped, and the crowd just went nuts. I mean, they went crazy, and that's when I got the goosebumps down the back of my neck. It was quite a feeling. Of course, Frank went on to win. The next time I had it was the year that Jay Cutler beat Ronnie Coleman. Same thing.
Okay.
And when Jay was in, everybody in the, and that was when the Orleans was sold out. I mean, there wasn't a seat. I don't think there was an empty seat in that build at that arena. And that held that holds a lot of people.
Yeah,
and that crowd had seen Jay try so hard for so long to beat Ronnie that it just wasn't happening. And tonight they sensed that it was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So it was when it was down to Ronnie and Jay.
Yeah,
and they announced Jay. That whole place just erupted, and everybody jumped to their feet. It was like all at once, just like a bomb had hit, and
mm-hmm.
everybody jumped to their feet screaming for Jay.
That's crazy.
They wanted Jay to win so bad, and I felt goosebumps again for that.
Yeah.
So, and I haven't felt a lot of goosebumps in the 30-some Olympias that I've been to, but that those were a couple.
That's great.
And of course, the worst I ever heard was in, I believe it was Munich in 83, when Bertel Fox was announced low.
Oh, yeah, fifth, yeah.
And Germans started booing, and that booing, I thought was going to be a riot. They started throwing pennies. They're whizzing by our heads. And that's what they do, in, I guess, over in Germany or in Europe when they're not happy. Start throwing coins or something.
They were doing that in 81, too, right? Did you notice that?
I don't recall it in 81.
Yeah,
they probably were, but I don't recall it. But I do remember how angry they were in Germany when Bertel Fox didn't. But Bertel's whole posing routine was just most musketers.
Mm-hmm.
And he posed the sexual healing by Marvin Gaye.
Right.
And of course,
right.
He just kept pumping most musketers. And the more he pumped most musketers, the crazier the audience got. Because
yeah.
They loved, you know, they loved Bertel Fox then. That was 83.
Yeah.
But I remember that well. But yeah, the crowd were not happy in 81. And a lot of fallout came from that. I mean, that really hurt bodybuilding, that win for Franco. I mean, it didn't do pro bodybuilding any good because it wasn't wasn't a very popular decision.
No.
What did Roy have
no.
to say about it? Have you guys broadcast the interview with Roy yet?
No, not yet. We did an interview on video that's on YouTube. And, you know, he seemed pretty resigned to it. He wasn't angry about it. And Danny Padilla, too, we interviewed him last week, and he was sort of the same way. He's just like, yeah, you know, that's just the way it goes. They didn't have any real animosity for it all these years later.
Are you going to try to get Platts?
Yeah, Tom said he might be able to talk to us in October. So.
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah, if you could get
his views on
it. I didn't see them around the Olympia this year. I don't know if they had a booth there or not. Last year, the three of them had a booth. There was Tom Platts, Danny, and Samir Banoot. They all were doing some clothing line they started. I saw Samir this year, but I never seen Danny or Platts.
Right.
I did have it was great. I did have a reunion with Danny and Platts last year at the Olympia, and it was great to see them. Danny still looks good. I mean, they all still look pretty good. I mean, they're not young anymore. They would be in their 50s and early 60s, I think.
I think 60s, yeah.
But it's quite, when I see them and I talk to you and I think back, those are great days and provide me with a lot of great memories.
I wanted to ask you about that, Gary. What do you think of, I mean, you were around back then in the 70s, so obviously the sport has changed a lot. The guys are much, much bigger. The posing isn't the same. So how do you look at the sport now and see how it's progressed?
That's a hard call because it's the evolution. I mean.
Yeah, different era.
Yeah, and you know, each champion has their own thing. I mean, Phil's a good champion. I mean, he's probably as big as you can get and still look, you know, still not look like a freak. You know what I mean? Like Ronnie was a total freak. I mean, no one had the muscle Ronnie Coleman had.
Mm-hmm.
I think that no champion at his best could come near what Ronnie had when he was in his prime.
Mm-hmm.
I actually saw him guest pose once at 300 pounds, six weeks before the Olympia. And it was the most awesome thing that I'd ever seen. I mean, I couldn't believe him. He was in fantastic shape, and he didn't look like he could have almost went on stage at the Olympia like that. I mean,
yeah.
I saw him. He was actually guest posing on a show here in Canada for Weider, got him to guest pose. But I mean, I never seen anything as huge and ripped as he was for that show.
Mm-hmm.
But he lost a lot of weight for the Olympia 6 weeks later, and I didn't think he improved a whole lot from what I saw him when he was posing at 300. I think he was down like 265.
Mm-hmm.
But the impact that I was expecting with the loss of the weight didn't kind of match up. I thought he maybe lost a little too much because he didn't seem to improve a whole lot for the amount he lost. So,
right.
But he still had to lose to get, you know, ripped for the show, but. You know, but getting back to your question, I always get sort of off track, but it's different today, and it's hard for me to be fair about it because with the amount of shows and that I've seen over the years and the amount of coverage I did, you certainly don't have the same mentality you had when you're first involved, you know, with mm-hmm. the passion. So I'm looking at it with more mature, different eyes now.
Yeah.
And for me, the excitement isn't, it takes a lot more to get that excitement or reaction from me than it did in those days. But each bodybuilder back then had their own distinct shape and mm-hmm. character and physique, because they could come out and do a silhouette and you knew immediately who they were. And now it's a little harder to distinguish one from the other.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're all just big now and thick and huge. But although, you know, they do have their traits, like, you know, like probably the most phenomenal bodybuilder on the stage today is Dexter Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dexter Jackson's going on 48 years old.
Yeah, that's
this
amazing.
This guy's placed in, you know, fourth in Olympia this year.
Yeah, amazing.
And he still has great symmetry and great conditioning and shows very little signs of aging.
Right.
And you just keep wondering when he's going to start to show signs of aging, but his muscles are still full, and he's, you know, got to remember he's only a few years younger than Flex Wheeler was when he got on stage. So it is quite incredible that at close to 48 that Dexter still can stand with the best of them.
Yeah, he is amazing.
But
yeah, I wonder the same thing. I look at back when I was a kid and seemed more magical back then, but, you know, it was a different time, too. We didn't have the internet back then, and, you know, we would only see these guys on stage, you know, once a year, and when you saw them in person, it was like seeing a movie star, because you would only see them in the magazines. You never saw them, videos of them, or you never saw them online or anything.
Yeah, now they're all on YouTube, and they're all on Facebook, and they're all Twittering and all that stuff. And, and then they were much more, you never got an opportunity to know what was going on. Olympia was only the only big show
mm-hmm.
a year. Everybody was gearing up for the Olympia, so it's very hard to put. And also, you got to remember, too, Sean, back then, there wasn't anything but the Mr. Olympia that day. There wasn't seven or eight other divisions going on, and you're rushing from one building to the other to cover the shows, and there's no socializing now because you don't have the time.
Right.
And you just wear yourself out the weekend, especially if you're covering it for, you know, if I'm covering it, say, for an online site, and I got to shoot the pictures of everybody and get it to them to download, you know,
mm-hmm.
on time. I mean, I don't really get a chance to socialize much. It's just pure hard work.
Yeah,
for me,
exactly.
I was covering it for a magazine here in Canada, Inside Fitness, so it wasn't as demanding for me. So I had a lot easier time than if I was shooting it for one of the magazines that put everything up online right away. So that was better. But and also back in those days, John, you couldn't even hardly buy a T-shirt. You're lucky if you could get a T-shirt as a souvenir. There was no
Fitness
Expos. There was no women's shows, even then. I mean, so everybody was focused on what was on stage at that time.
Yeah. Know,
there was no competition. You didn't have a group of people.
No expo.
And you get a lot of people going through expos, couldn't care less about the show.
Yeah.
They're just there to get free stuff.
Right.
And then you got people going there to see figure. You got people going there to see men's physique. You got people going there to see bikini, and you know, then so you got thousands of people going, but maybe out of those thousands, you only got maybe a small portion that were really passionate about the guys on stage for Mr.
Olympia. Yeah, it's a different time for sure.
Exactly, and see, when we had the veterans plugged up with pure hardcore fanatical fans,
mm-hmm.
that's when you fed off them, and that's when you got that, you know, that pure feeling that this was something special. So yeah, it's quite a different time. And I kind of feel bad for the guys today who are the top guys because they, you know, it's a little harder for them to get something out of the, they have to work a lot harder to get something out of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have the advantage of having a much more lying to the people because of the social media and stuff. And in fairness to these guys today, I mean, these guys are making darn good money compared to what these guys were back then. I mean,
how about it?
I think Phil got, what, 400, 450, thousand for first place. I mean,
right.
I don't think any of those guys made that in their whole career.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, and Phil's been making that now probably, well, 7 years. He's probably, so mm-hmm. you multiply seven times an average of 300,000, he's made a couple million dollars.
Yeah.
In his seven wins.
Just off contest wins.
And now these guys also, too, get nice seminars and nice posing, you know, get nice, you know, but that's only the top guys. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you're not going to get that if you win the men's physique championships. I don't think you're going to make a lot of money from it.
Right.
If you're Mr. Olympia, there are opportunities that they never had back then. So I guess you can take the good with the bad.
But right.
It's definitely evolved, and the evolution continues to change and often hard to keep up with the Internet, because the Internet's, you know, destroyed print. I mean, very few print industry exists now. Mm. It's also pretty well taken away the careers that we had as photojournalists, because I have no clients anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no publishing, you know, there's no money available to buy photos and that. So
yeah.
I was fortunate to experience it when the going was good.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I've been very fortunate in my career and met some great people, and certainly one of them was Robert Kennedy and
mm-hmm.
Ben Weider and Joe. I've met them, and Arnold and Mannion and Robin Chang with the new group. So I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of new things coming, I'm sure, with what's
yeah.
happening. So, and also great, John, to have got the chance to be on your show. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you being here, Gary. I know you got a long career in the sport, and I've followed your articles and your photographs for many, many years. So it was great to finally get to meet you and talk to you and hear all your recollections of all those years.
Well, it was nice to still be recognized, and I feel like the old guy walking around through the expo there.
mm-hmm.
And don't you guys know who I am? It's not who you are, it's who you were.
Yeah.
So it's good to know there's a few out there in the industry that still remember the good old days and some of the articles and things. And what I will do for you, John, too, is I'm going to grab a few photos, comparison shots, to send you from that 81 Olympia. And,
yeah, thank you. We'll put it on our photo section of the website.
Put on your photo section with a link to the interview, and
okay.
Or use them for your Danny Padilla thing or Roy thing, so you can use them to.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, we'll put them on Facebook.
Well, thank you, Gary. I appreciate that. And thank you again for joining us.
No, it's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thanks again for joining us and for sharing all your stories. We really do appreciate it.
No problem, John. I appreciate it talking to you as well. Take care,
take
John.
Take care. All right, buddy. You too. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Join us next week when our guest will be Roy Callender. Roy, of course, was one of the top bodybuilders in the 1981 Mr. Olympia. Most people had him in the top three, along with Tom Platz and Danny Padilla. So Roy is going to join us and give us his thoughts on the 1981 Mr. Olympia, where he achieved his best ever shape. I want to thank Gary Bartlett again for joining us for the show. And I also want to thank our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. We'll see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thanks.